is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, the polls have been run and won, and today on the Country Hour, we're going to pore over some of the results to discuss what this election means for rural Australia agriculture and what policies we could see in the future. Votes are still being counted and a number of seats are still undecided, but it is certain that a government under Anthony Albanese will be formed. So, what do you make of it? What are your thoughts, feelings and predictions? I've already got some comments sent my way on social media. I'd love to know yours, though. 1300 977 222 to call us today on the Country Hour. 1300 977 222. You can text as well, 0467 842 722. Here are some of my notes, and I'd love your thoughts on this. Labor's looking for a new water and environment minister because despite winning government, it's now almost certain shadow environment and water minister Terry Butler has lost her seat to the Greens. So there is the water spokesman has now not made it into a Labor government. The agriculture portfolio is uncertain. The industry is looking very dissatisfied with the performance of Julie Collins and is now looking for someone else to take charge. It's unclear if the Albanese leadership team, though, will listen to them, and if so, who that person might be. The National Party did not lose a seat, but it will now be in opposition. And as for policy, the agriculture visa is dead. It will be rolled into some form of the Pacific Labor Scheme. Now, a plan will be developed to end the live export of sheep from Australia. And it's unclear if buybacks are back or not in the Murray-Darling. We're going to talk through all of this and more, and you can give me your thoughts. 1300 977 222. Right now, though, on the Country Hour, let's head to Rural News and Kelly Lazzaro. Kelly.
Thanks, Woz. A major Australian cattle station owner is concerned about the outbreak of two potentially devastating diseases close to our border. Troy Setter is the head of the Consolidated Pastoral Company, which owns several cattle stations across northern Australia and two feedlots in Indonesia. He's been in Indonesia over the last 2 weeks as the country grapples with lumpy skin disease and foot and mouth disease. He says while Indonesia is doing its best, foot and mouth has spread rapidly across all of the major islands in Indonesia and is now in Lombok on the eastern side of Bali.
One thing that's not really being reported on up here is that the foot and mouth disease is also in sheep, goats and pigs, but there's a very strong focus on cattle. We have a large number of our team up here have goats and a few have cattle at home. So if it was to get even closer in our region, the chance of our team accidentally bringing it into work on clothing and footwear is absolutely real, or it blowing in. So we've dramatically increased the biosecurity and washing and cleanliness of every person going in and out, every truck going in and out of the feedlots.
To a lesser-known commodity, have you ever heard of jojoba seed? Jojobas are small trees that store wax in their seeds, wax which is then used in a wide range of beauty products as a substitute for oils. Claire Felton-Taylor has finished planting her first trees in Narrabri in northwest New South Wales and aims to have 40,000 trees in the ground across 15 hectares.
A jojoba seed, it can look like a coffee bean. A lot of people will refer to it as a coffee bean. But if you think of it a little bit like a macadamia, not completely, when it sits on the plant, it has a leathery kind of casing around it, which is, it then opens and it falls to the ground, and it's the seed then that is what we are after. So when the seed, at the moment, 50% of the seed is actually liquid wax. Most people think it's an oil, but it's not. It's technically a liquid wax. When it's crushed, we cold press the seed, and it produces about 40 to 42% liquid wax. It is very similar to your own oil in your skin, the sebum that your skin produces.
I'd like to introduce you now to Australia's youngest sugar mill manager, who's in charge of one of Australia's oldest sugar mills. Harrison Slowgrove was just 25 years old when he was appointed production superintendent of the McNaid Mill in far north Queensland. In a sweet synchronicity, he also just happens to be managing the oldest sugar mill in Queensland, which has been in operation for 148 years. He says it's a responsibility he doesn't take lightly.
I love how dynamic the sugar industry is. I guess because the quality of our incoming material, the sugarcane, can change so much from paddock to paddock, and even with the weather. So it makes the operation of the processing plant very challenging. Every day I come to work and there's a new problem to solve or process to improve, which means I'm certainly never bored. It's also pretty diverse from an engineering sense. There's so many different unit processes like clarification, evaporation or crystallization. Which means you're constantly testing all of your skills in order to meet our objectives like crush rate, sugar quality and recovery.
And that's Rural News for today.
Thanks very much for that. Kelly Lazzaro there with Rural News.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
What is your make of the election? What are your thoughts, feelings, predictions? Now it looks like we will have an Albanese government, depending on the numbers, either in majority or a small minority government going through to the next election cycle. 1300 977 222. If you want to call, comments coming in. Lindsay says agriculture will need good advocacy re climate change, or we risk being swamped by misguided assumptions. Hopefully, we can play a positive role. Jeremy says majority government is preferable to minority, and once it's clear who holds which ministry, to continue the existing relationship or establish a new one. Water is looking like a new relationship with Terry Butler at risk. The Senate looks even more challenging for the government. This comment's come through as well, saying some of our agriculture leaders will have to be a lot smarter in their policy pitch to make sure the crossbench understands the issues. No more pork barrelling and funds for silly projects. Great that climate change will now be properly addressed. Agriculture and regions could be really big winners out of this. And this one says, I'm in intensive agriculture and the change for live sheep exports is concerning, but a brighter future for climate change is the biggest win for us all. Keep those comments coming. 0467 842 722 if you want to text, or you can call 1300 977 222. That's what John has called from Shepparton. John, welcome to the Country Hour.
How are you going?
I'm good. What do you make of the election results?
Well, I think we've been sold a pup, to be honest. I'm an environmental planner, so I'm qualified to talk on this matter. But at the end of the day, Australia provides or emits 1% of world's global emissions. Australia's got 16 coal-fired power stations, whereas China, the USA, India and Europe have got over 2,000 coal.
So, it's John, can I just put you, I don't need to prosecute climate change with you. If you don't believe in it, that's okay. Or if you don't believe in Australia's ability to respond to that. But what do you think about the policy that you're going to see from the government? How do you think this government will deliver policies in this space?
Okay. I don't think whatever they do, it won't make a difference. Inflation won't come down. Interest rates will go up because it's a worldwide phenomenon. And I don't think it's going to make any difference at which level of government, whether it's Liberal, National, whatever. I don't think it's going to make a tinker's damn difference.
Solved then, John. The election won't make a difference to climate change policy. I think it might in terms of what rolled out here, but I get your point. Thank you for your call. 1300 977 222. A few more of your comments. Kath Sullivan's with us in a moment. We'll go to her and speak about the wash-up of the election, some of the results there. Kate says, intelligent, rural and regionally aware independents will be essential for navigating ag and water policy. Not many regional independents won, though. It was more a city-based thing this election. I'm hopeful that we have a government who listens to science and makes decisions for the long-term benefit of agriculture, says another comment here, rather than short-term economic gain. The future generations can continue our family traditions, adapting and improving the craft honed by our ancestors, is another comment coming in. Keep the texts coming. 0467 842 722. Let's look at the wash-up now. The Labor Party will be looking for a new Water and Environment Minister, the crossbench that we don't know exactly which way it will go on regional issues, and many more key points of discussion are to be made out of this federal election and what's to come. To help it guide us through some of that, our reporter based in Canberra, Kath Sullivan, who's spent time on the Wombat Trail and also in key seats during this election campaign, can join you now to talk through it all. Kath Sullivan, welcome back to the country.
G'day there, Warwick.
What do you make of the election and the results that are still coming in from the weekend?
Oh, look, I don't think anybody quite expected the results that we saw coming in on Saturday night. Obviously, given what had happened at the last election when Bill Shorten had been widely anticipated to form government, that didn't happen. I think people were really keeping their powder dry and reluctant to make any sort of forecast or prediction. We knew that Scott Morrison, as the Prime Minister, had been perhaps less popular heading into the election, but I don't think anybody expected to see quite the poor showing of the Liberals that we saw right across the country. Nobody saw Labor having such a phenomenal result in the West. And, well, the teal slide and the green slide, as they've been labelled, I think nobody really saw that coming either.
So we're left with a really interesting parliament to look at in terms of what it means for rural and regional Australia. Labor still have a chance at governing in their own right. There's a massive crossbench, and the Senate could be really interesting to look at too. Is there anything at the top of your mind that you're watching at the moment?
Oh, well, obviously we want to see exactly who does win a seat in the House of Representatives and whether Anthony Albanese will require support from the independents to actually have government. At this stage, there seems to be a bit of confidence amongst the Labor bunch that they'll get there in their own right and won't have to rely on the support of others. But, we're talking about three, maybe four Greens in the lower house. So that's a significant change there. And of course, well, I think there might be up to 15 independents in the lower house, which is really significant. But when it comes to rural Australia and the regional policies, it is a bit of a waiting game to see actually who is going to be the minister responsible for portfolios such as water and environment. Those were held by Terry Butler for Labor, who was ousted by a Green in her Brisbane seat of Griffith. So it's going to be really interesting to see who takes charge in terms of Murray-Darling Basin policy. We know that Labor has a policy to see more water returned to the environment, or to see 450 gigalitres of water committed. So that's a massive one that a lot of people will be holding out for. And in terms of Western Australia, Labor's policy to ban live sheep exports there obviously didn't have much of an influence on the vote in Western Australia, because we saw such a, I saw it described as a savage swing to Labor in the West. But obviously I'm very keen for that industry to find out exactly what plans Labor has for a transition away from that trade and how they think they're going to replace that sector, which was worth close to $100 million last year.
Yeah, I can't imagine anyone would have thought Terry Butler would be losing her seat, but is there any idea on who could or who has the knowledge in the environment and particularly the water space too, with the Murray-Darling being a hot issue and one where Labor has a defined policy? Any thought on who could be taking that portfolio?
It's interesting, isn't it? We know that Tony Burke and Penny Wong have both held the portfolio for Labor in the past. They've moved on, I guess you would say, from that portfolio. I don't think that Labor did expect to lose Griffith. The Greens had been encroaching there, and you could see that some of the policies, and I think just the fact that Terry Butler held the environment portfolio perhaps was one way of offsetting that challenge. It didn't work. So they're going to have to find somebody new to take on that portfolio. And it's sort of, there have been a lot of questions asked about Julie Collins, who currently holds the agriculture portfolio for Labor, whether or not she'll stay in the gig. She told us last week on the Country Hour that she definitely wants the job, but there has been some unease amongst industry, questions asked about her willingness to engage on policy. We saw there weren't a lot of agriculture policies announced by Labor in the run-up to the election. The one that I mentioned before, the phase-out of the live sheep exports, wasn't actually announced by Labor. It leaked to the media care of an animal rights group, which is a pretty... Well, it's a really interesting way to be announcing significant policies, shutting down trades.
does the industry put forward anybody they would like to be agriculture minister, or are there any front runners there?
Well, this is the funny thing was everyone you talk to is going to say publicly at least, oh, we look forward to working with the incoming Labor agriculture minister, and we want to make sure that Labor's aware of our issues and our concerns about, you know, water or labor or animal welfare or carbon credits, whatever it might be. And that's true. Everybody's going to have to find a way to work with this new parliament, and we yet don't know the actual makeup of that. There have been names put forward. Victorian Senator Raph Jaconi is a backbencher. He's only had, I think, one term of parliament. He's shown a real interest in issues to do with agriculture. He turns up at a lot of industry events. Others, like maybe Senator Murray Watt, who's in Queensland, he's had the portfolio for resources and Northern Australia. He's very good at talking to people that are involved in regional and rural issues. But you've got this thing going on with Labor where the factions are at play, and it will be up to Anthony Albanese's caucus to ensure that they have satisfactory representation from their various factions. So, look, anything could happen. I'm often reminded when people say, oh, who could Labor have in terms of agriculture? You know, they don't have a lot of rural and regional MPs or senators. But Andrew Broad, who many people might remember as a former Nationals member for Mallee in Victoria, he was actually the president of the Victorian Farmers Federation at one stage. And I clearly recall him saying that sometimes it's better to deal with a Labor agriculture minister because they may not have preconceived ideas that those coming to the role might have if they were perhaps a farmer or employed in agriculture to start with.
And speaking of those concerns and those issues, what are the policies that we know about from Labor that they took to the election, particularly for agriculture?
Okay, well, it was quite interesting that Labor didn't really announce any agriculture-specific policies right up until the very end. Whenever we approached Julie Collins, the shadow minister, and said, you know, last time Labor had this idea and that idea, putting a floor in the farmgate milk price, or, you know, she kept saying, we'll have more to say, we'll have more to say, we'll have more to say. And she didn't have a lot more to say until right up to the very end of the election campaign, when we learned that Labor does want to put an end to live sheep exports. One of the most significant areas of difference, I guess you could say, between the coalition and between Labor is on the Australian agriculture visa. This is something the coalition promised. It hasn't really delivered in full yet. We know there's a memorandum of understanding with Vietnam to bring workers from that country to come and work on Australian farms and in forestry and fisheries as well. Labor says it will honour that MOU, but it's not going to ask any other countries to sign up and participate in this Australian agriculture visa program. It's effectively scrapping it and saying we can fill the farm worker void by bringing in workers under the Pacific Australia Labor Mobility Scheme.
So scrapping the agriculture visa, ending the live sheep export industry, and some commitments around getting the additional 450 gigalitres of water under the Murray-Darling Basin plan. We don't know much else beyond that, do we?
We don't, but I think that the new incoming water and agriculture ministers are certainly going to have their work cut out for them. It's a really interesting time for the industry and in terms of the Murray-Darling Basin plan. There are so many challenges. Just think about foot and mouth disease and lumpy skin disease just to the north of the country. Biosecurity is a great concern to the sector. And
Kath, also, can I jump in there and just ask about the performance of the Nationals? We've looked a lot at what this new government might look at like, but there's also the regional party that has held the agriculture and water portfolios in the previous government. How did the Nationals perform during this election, and what are they saying today?
Well, that really depends if your glass is half full or half empty, Warwick, because you can make the case for the Nats having not a bad showing at the weekend. Under Barnaby Joyce's leadership, the party was able to hold on to all of its seats, which, you know, Anthony Albanese and Scott Morrison certainly couldn't say this morning. but it didn't pick up any extra ground. And we did see swings against it in some of the Nationals held electorates. In fact, in New South Wales, in Cowper, it's incredibly tight there, with Pat Conaghan being challenged by an independent. And we do know that the Nationals, after every election, spill the leadership of the party. Barnaby Joyce, it's going to be fascinating. The fact that Nats MPs and senators have been talking about the next leadership ballot prior to the election even is quite interesting. We know that Barnaby Joyce, some of his backers retired at the last at the election at the weekend. So whether there's still support for his leadership will be really interesting, and how much responsibility the party accepts for the coalition's defeat at the weekend. I mean, is it up to the Nationals to have Josh Frydenberg get elected in Kooyong or Dave Sharma get elected in his inner city seat? Several of the Teal candidates, the independents in the inner city blue ribbon seats, or traditionally blue ribbon Liberal held seats, were campaigning on a fact that a vote for Tim Wilson or Trent Zimmerman was in fact a vote for Barnaby Joyce. So I think it's going to be fascinating to see where the Nats go from here. Would they dare to not sign on to the coalition in opposition? I think there's going to be a lot of questions asked in the coming days, weeks and months.
Kath Sullivan, thank you so much for joining us and poring over the results. I'm sure we'll be speaking about what's actually happened a lot more in the coming days.
Good on you, Woz. Thanks.
That's Kath Sullivan, who is our national reporter in Canberra, covering a lot of rural and regional issues, taking you through what she sees in the result. Many of you are having your say as well on the text line, and we can go through a lot of those now. This election result is terrible for agriculture, says this one on the text line. If Julie Collins becomes agriculture minister, it will be a disaster. I heard her speaking during the election campaign, and to say I was unimpressed is an understatement. David Littleproud is the best agriculture minister that Australia has ever had. He should retain his position in the job, says that text. Well, that's obviously not going to happen. They will not be in government, but thank you for your text. Labor and the Greens are going to take away the fuel excise from farmers, which is a road tax, says Phil. That's clearly what Phil is worried about at the moment. This one says Zoe should have an idea about rural issues. Yeah, I was going to mention that today. There is a former Country Hour presenter that is now going to be a member of Parliament. Zoe Daniel, who used to present this very program, did win as an independent in Goldstein in Melbourne. Simon says, your caller was right. New climate policies won't make any difference, much to your obvious disgust. Simon, my disgust was, I was saying everybody's policies weren't going to make a difference. Well, why are we talking about it when we're talking about the wash-up of the election and what is going to change? That's where the disgust came from, but you're allowed to have your say. Darren Chester got a positive swing. He should be made the new leader of the Nationals, says this one on the text line. ICAC now, let's stop corruption in the water trade, says Harry. This one says, so a letter writer MP takes his orders from Big Cotton and the miners, and CSG in the north is going to get something done on the MDBA. If my experience with the seed industry is any guide, I don't think so, says that text. I don't know if that's commenting about a future or an ex water minister. And this one says, Penny Wong is water minister. Oh boy, what went wrong? Well, Penny Wong has been a water minister. She has been already sworn in as foreign minister of Australia, so you can rule that one out in the future. And Andrew says, if you want to predict the future just after the election, just look at what's happening in the USA. I predict our economy is going to crash, says Andrew at Kadunga. You can keep those texts coming, 0467 842 722. As you can see, wide and varied is the response to this election. I'd love to know what you're watching, what you think is a policy area that you'd like to know more about, particularly as it looks like we'll be under an Albanese government now in Australia. Well, we will be under an Albanese government. What that government looks like is the bit that's being decided at the moment. The ABC, looking up at the screen right now, is calling 72 seats for Labor, 52 seats to the Liberal and National parties, 15 for other, the crossbench there, and 12 seats still in doubt. Now, Labor has to get to 76 to govern in its own right, and it clearly has not made it there yet. So it will govern either with a small, needing some small numbers from that 15 seats on the crossbench, or it could get to the 76 or 77, depending on how those seats that are still in doubt break. You're listening to The Country Hour. We are talking about the wrap-up to the election and what it means for rural and regional Australia. I can tell you outgoing Agriculture Minister David Littleproud has been speaking. He's retaining his seat in Maranoa for the Nationals, and he spoke about leaving his legacy on the portfolio and working with a new government to our colleagues on the Queensland Country Hour. Here's a little of that.
I wish the new government well. In fact, I've reached out to Anthony Albanese. I know Anthony well. He is a good bloke. Genuinely is a good bloke. And we've had a conversation about making sure that while regional Australia isn't traditionally on the radar of the Labor Party, he's given me an undertaking that, you know, he's going to work constructively with us. And I thank him for that, because that's important. Regardless of who holds the Treasury benches, it's important that people in regional and rural Australia aren't forgotten. And Anthony, to his word, has said that he will continue to work constructively with me, and that's a great sign.
What will the future of Australian agriculture be under Labor with the possible independent Green crossbench?
Well, look, I hope what I tried to achieve was to leave a legacy, and that legacy will now be tested. And I just hope that what I've been able to do has been one that hasn't been destructive. It's been constructive as Agriculture Minister, and I hope the new Agriculture Minister just carries on from the foundation stones that I've put down. And I'll be reaching out to whoever that is, not to be combative, but to actually be constructive in trying to make sure that legacy continues. I think that's our job. That's our opportunity. The privilege we've been given as politicians to represent people is to make a difference and to leave a legacy. I hope my legacy in the agricultural sector will continue on, and I'll work with the government on that, but we'll also hold them to account.
And speaking on Facebook today, the member for Gippsland, Darren Chester, says this is the message for the Nationals, is despite holding ground while the coalition went backwards, you have to recognise the changing sentiment throughout Australia, lurching further to the political right is a recipe for irrelevance when you consider Pauline Hanson's One Nation has never won a seat in the House of Representatives, end quote. That's from Darren Chester of Facebook today, talking about the wash-up for the Nationals. And on the Nationals, they did retain the seat of Nichols in Northern Victoria too, where we did a broadcast from during the election campaign. You can keep your thoughts coming in, 0467 842 722. We'll talk away from the election after the news and weather though, where GrainCorp have announced they're significantly expanding the area that they'll be, the storage options for Victorian farmers before the next harvest. We'll talk through their plans on the program shortly, and then we'll chat about a few other things as well. Right now, though, let's find out what's making regional news headlines, though. Bensian Siebert can do that for us today. Good afternoon, Bensian.
Good afternoon, Woz. The Gippsland region saw the first and third largest swings statewide towards Pauline Hanson's One Nation in the federal election over the weekend. The party ran a candidate in the seat of Gippsland for the first time and received 9.2% of the primary vote. Candidate Greg Hansford said young tradespeople in particular abandoned the Labor Party to vote for One Nation. Re-elected Nationals Mallee incumbent Anne Webster says she was very surprised the coalition lost the election and had hoped they would sneak in one last time. She says she has concerns about funding for childcare in Dunmunkle, sports precincts in Nil and Donnelly, and the wet lab in Mildura now that her party is in opposition. She says it's devastating to have to go back to the drawing board, but that she'll reach across the aisle to lobby for her electorate. The Victorian Farmers Federation says Labor's plan to scrap the newly created agriculture visa will be a blow for horticultural producers. The incoming government plans to replace the program with a new agriculture stream within the existing Pacific Australia Labor Mobility Scheme. Bendigo MP Lisa Chesters says she will have to fend off tough competition from well-known Labor MPs to get a seat in Anthony Albanese's ministry. Ms Chesters has been in opposition for the past 9 years and is beginning her fourth term as the member for Bendigo. With three quarters of votes counted in the Bendigo electorate, Ms Chesters has 62% of the vote after preferences. In other news, police are investigating after two staff members were assaulted at the Malmesbury Youth Justice Centre at the weekend. They say a female staff member was taken to hospital on Saturday afternoon after she was attacked while inmates were being moved. Just 5 hours later, a male staff member was attacked by an inmate and has minor injuries. A spokesperson for the Department of Justice says there are tough penalties for inmates that attack justice workers. And the Victorian opposition is calling for greater greater clarity around whether Shepparton will host events for the 2026 Commonwealth Games. Minister for Sport Martin Pakula told Public Accounts and Estimates last week that he was still keen for Shepparton to host events, but couldn't confirm anything. And Warwick, those are the news headlines.
I'm keen to know that too. Thank you very much for that, Pence and Sievert there with regional news headlines. Obviously speaking to me, Warwick Long in Shepparton. That's why I'd be keen to know that, wouldn't I? For the Country Hour today. The Country Hour often comes to you from our Shepparton studios, but we try and get out of the office a fair bit. If you know something or you're holding an event or you would like us to come and broadcast from wherever you are, you can always send us an email, countryhour@abc.net.au. I love getting your emails, countryhour@abc.net.au. A couple of your election wash-up text messages before we head to the Weather Bureau. This one says, we're all due for a change for the better. Change is as good as a holiday. The old saying is, if it's not broken, don't fix it, just doesn't cut it. The government was broken and with so many industries as well. Agriculture is one of them. They're the thoughts coming in from one of our texters. Another one says, this election shows that the city-country divide is massive. The only party standing for the country is Nationals. We will suffer badly under Labor governments beholden to climate-focused politicians, is the thoughts of John in Northern Victoria. And this one says, Warwick, when the 450 gigalitres in the Murray-Darling Basin plan is gone, it will no doubt... it will be no doubt. Where will all these people think the food and fibre is going to come from? We're already struggling with milk, says this one on the text message. And one going back to elections past, John Howard's greatest achievement was gun law reform. His worst, though, was weakening Australia's biosecurity control. I actually think that's in reference to the conversation hour that we just had on looking at foot and mouth disease. Thank you very much for your text all the same. Miriam Bradbury is a senior forecaster at the Weather Bureau. We don't need to talk about the election with Miriam. We need to talk about what the weather's doing. And it's blue skies and sunny weather here today in Shepparton. Miriam?
Yeah, and pretty much right across the state as well. That's thanks to that high-pressure system, which is currently sitting just east of Tasmania, going to move out across the Tasman Sea throughout the course of the next couple of days. But what that means for Victoria is a continuation of these very settled weather, the clear skies and the morning fogs and frost. So it was another cool one this morning. We saw minimum temperatures dropping down to below 3 degrees through much of the southwest district, but also up through the Goulburn Valley and also through the Latrobe Valley. But very few parts of the state really pushing above 8-9 degrees even elsewhere. So there were some frost and fog patches around this morning, but they've nicely cleared away as the sun's come up. So yeah, pretty much cloud-free skies right across the state today. It will still be a fairly cool one though. Maximum temperatures generally only reaching between around 16 and 18 degrees. Touch warmer in the northwest, but all around, yeah, a little bit cool for this time of year, but I suppose it's May. This is what we expect. Having a look at tomorrow, we're going to see these very settled conditions continuing. Another cool morning, but the frost risk is really going to be contracting to eastern parts of the state with the coolest temperatures across those eastern districts. But that's not to say it won't be a cold morning elsewhere. It's just that those very lowest temperatures won't quite be as widespread as they have been across the weekend. But yeah, another very settled day tomorrow, very similar in terms of the maximum temperatures. The main difference is that towards the end of the day, we are going to see the winds gradually tending northeasterly. And this is coming in ahead of a trough, which will be approaching the western parts of the state during Wednesday, eventually bringing a little bit more cloud cover and some showers to those western districts through the later part of our Wednesday. In terms of the rainfall totals we're expecting, unfortunately not really too much. The westernmost parts of the Wimmera and Mallee could see between around 2 and 8 millimetres through the afternoon and evening period on Wednesday, but away from those areas, those numbers are really dropping off. So unfortunately, the southwest district, which is continuing to see rainfall deficiencies, even now we're moving through autumn, really not looking at more than a couple of millimetres for Wednesday. But as we go into Thursday and Friday, the end of the week, we're going to see that trough moving across the state. Ooh. So we are going to see these showers becoming more extensive, but the rainfall totals, unfortunately, still not looking very high across that. yeah, it's sort of weather happening, but it's not the weather we want. So we are going to get these patchy showers, but to the end of Friday, the cumulative rainfall totals are going to be highest across the northern slopes and the northeast ranges, generally 10 to 20 millimetres, with only around 5 to 10 millimetres elsewhere across the state. The patchy, showery weather will continue into the weekend as well, a little bit cooler across the weekend, but still those rainfall totals are not going to be very high, particularly across those western parts of the state, which are hoping for a little bit more rainfall. The best chance of that is going to be this time next week. So the other end of our 7-day forecast period, when we're expecting a more significant frontal system to sweep across Victoria. It's at this point looking as though it's bringing the potential for some stronger winds, but also some higher rainfall totals. So that's the one to watch. And until then, we're really just looking at a few very settled, clear days, and then a few fairly settled, but a bit more of that showery weather to come for the end of the week.
It's one of those hard ones when you're a forecaster. There'd be a lot of happy people with these blue sky, sunny weather, you know, pre-winter days, but a lot of people looking for rain as well. So there's a couple of fronts there for people to keep an eye on, though, isn't there?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And look, for us here at the Weather Bureau, it just reminds us the range of people who we're serving. You know, it's like everybody has different needs. And so, yeah, rain is good news for some and obviously bad news for others. And we'll just take what we can get this week. The sunshine for some people, the showers for others, and we'll keep an eye on the potential for heavier falls later next week.
Brilliant. Miriam, thank you very much for that. Any warnings we need to be aware of just before we let you go?
It's likely that we'll see a couple of frost warnings out for those eastern parts of the state. Yep. That'll be issued later today. But apart from that, no warnings to speak of.
Fantastic. Thanks, Miriam.
No worries.
Miriam Bradbury, Senior Forecaster at the Weather Bureau, taking you through the full forecast there with a little bit on the horizon to keep an eye on. We're going to move away from the election shortly and talk about an increase in grain storage from large bulk storage and handler GrainCorp. But just a couple of your texts before we do that. This one says, this election result is a wake-up call to everyone in ag and small business to get off the couch and get involved, says Bill at Ngiambi. This one says, every action has a reaction. I once was told the actions of the coalition have had a reaction and the people have voted. And this one says, I'm yet to be convinced that Labor independent policies will make one scrap of difference to the climate. The climate and climate policies are clearly important to you all. Well, many of you on the text line at the moment. It's interesting to see that response. And Tony at Avenel says, was a clarification on your Nicholls summary. The Nationals retained the seat but had a minus 15% swing, losing the primary vote but saved by Liberal, United Australia Party and One Nation preferences. That's true, Tony, but they weren't competing against the Liberal Party or a high-profile independent last election. So obviously a very different election as well, and the seat was still won by around a 5% margin as it stands at the moment, but certainly one to watch, and we'll see what happens there. 0467 842 722. You can continue your text coming, but we'll talk about grain storage next.
On ABC Radio Victoria, you're with Warwick Long for the Victorian Country Hour.
Yeah, large grain storage and handler, bulk handler on the East Coast, GrainCorp says it's going to build more capacity to take a larger harvest this season. Nick Chambers is the head of grower services and can join you on the Country Hour now. Nick Chambers, welcome to the Country Hour.
Thanks, Warwick. Thanks for having us.
What can you tell us about this announcement?
Yeah, so we're looking at expanding another 2 million tonnes of storage across the network, across the East Coast, leading into this harvest, Warwick, which will build on 1.5 million tonnes, which we built last year to try and accommodate these very sizable crops that last year a couple thrown at us. So, yeah, exciting. Will hopefully go a long way to making sure that there's sufficient storage to handle as much of the crop next year as possible if these great conditions continue.
So 2 million tonnes of extra storage in your network, that seems significant, is it?
Yeah, it is. So we took in the vicinity of about 14 million tonnes into the network across the East Coast last year, and that was with 1.5 million tonnes of storage being built. Obviously, we're building some carry within the network, so the addition of another 2 million will hopefully allow us to achieve a similar task again as last year. Warwick.
So when you're saying you're going to expand the network by 2 million tonnes, you're taking sort of 14 to 16, like that's a big increase. What kind of infrastructure is that? Is that more silos? Is that bunkers? What kind of things are you looking at?
Yeah, it'll all be bunkers. Yeah, definitely not enough lead time between now and harvest to be building silos. Yeah, it'll all be bunkers, and also it'll be expanding the capacity of existing infrastructure on sites through higher bunker walls and things like that, Warwick. So, yeah, most of it will be obviously new dirt, new gravel going down for pads, but some of it will also be being able to increase the capacity of existing infrastructure, which is great.
And what sort of areas of the country? The East Coast, GrainCorp is a big company over a large area. Are you looking at to build this extra capacity?
The extra capacity will go in every state across the East Coast, obviously including Victoria. It'll be the whole eastern seaboard, and really focused in some areas where we can expand, and we do have the existing land to expand, and also obviously areas where back-to-back record crops are meaning that existing infrastructure will probably fall short of what we're expecting this year.
So you can't give me locations, can you?
Yeah, we're just working through that, Warwick, and I think it'll be in the next couple of weeks where we'll have the final approvals for that. We have to go through many approvals, councils, DAs, etc. So once each one is ticked off, you'll be hearing from GrainCorp most weeks as we announce which sites are coming online.
I suppose the fact that you're building 2 million tonnes of storage is a sign of a couple of things, isn't it? One, that we've had some pretty massive crops come from the East Coast in recent years, and we're looking down the barrel at another one. And two, that the company GrainCorp must have confidence that large areas of cropping land will continue to produce into the future.
Definitely. The last couple of years has obviously been good for the grains industry as a whole. And I think, we've pretty good moisture profiles everywhere at the moment. And we just heard from Miriam on what the long range or the next 7 to 14 days looks like across Victoria. I think, with the most moisture profiles we're seeing, it's definitely giving GrainCorp confidence to invest at the moment.
And obviously this is a lot of infrastructure to make you physically be able to take more grain. There are a couple of texts here saying hopefully you're investing in more weigh bridges and sample monitors and so forth. What about that back of house infrastructure? Is that something you're keeping an eye on constantly to work out you've got enough of that to keep the trucks rolling?
It absolutely is. So as part of this program as well, we're doing a huge upgrade to all our mobile fleet. And also looking at sites in the network where we do have obviously known issues, bottlenecks with sample stands, weigh bridges, trying to fix some of the traffic flow problems across different sites in the network. So there's obviously a storage expansion. On top of that, there's also a significant investment in the mobile fleet. So that's front-end loaders, it's stackers, it's drive-over grids, it's tarpaulins, it's everything. So the 2 million tonnes of extra storage is sort of the first storage part, but there's infrastructure and also a lot of, how we look at it, site turnaround time and process improvements on sites as well, which we'll hopefully achieve. So, yes, a lot of the sites in the network we'll look at from an end-to-end point of view.
Nick Chambers, thanks very much for the update. Is there anything else we need to know before we let you go?
No, that's it, Warwick. I think just keep posted for growers out there who get our weekly grower email. Please watch that closely. We'll be releasing information on what sites are getting expansions and also more information on all the mobile equipment we'll be upgrading and purchasing for harvest. So just keep an eye on our GrainCorp grower weekly email. Thank you.
Thanks for your time. Nick Chambers there, Head of Grower Services at GrainCorp, with the update for you. 2 million tonnes of extra capacity going into the GrainCorp network. It's huge in terms of how much they actually take and now what they're going to build. You can let us know what you think of that. Dave at Baruga. Dave, I was asking that question on your behalf. Hopefully GrainCorp will put more weigh bridges and more sample monitors in. Waiting 2 hours last year for a sample and a falling numbers test was a joke, says Dave at Baruga. Well, you've heard there'll be more investment there, but if it doesn't work for you again this spring, summer harvest, Dave, let us know. Get in touch with us in the Country Hour, and we can always follow up on your behalf. You're listening to the Country Hour. It is 12 to 1.
You're with Warwick Long for the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
We'll stay away from the election as still and talk about Australia's best dried fruit growers, because for 2022 that have just been recognised on this weekend. See, we'll spend all our time talking about the election. We should have been talking about the winners of the Dried Fruit Awards, which exactly we'll do now. The top award went to Simon and Janice Shivers, who grow sultanas in Merbein. The awards were presented at the Mildura Field Days by Dried Fruits Australia Deputy Chairman Warren Lloyd, who explains how they were judged.
First of all, we've got two major processors in the industry, Australian Premium Dried Fruits and Sunbeam. They will both put up samples of a particular variety that they deem to be the best quality. In the case of Sultana, you'd want to see fruit that doesn't have any damage, so no mould damage. We are generally looking for light-coloured fruit. And, you know, it's a fruit that when you look at it, it looks really clear. So both of those companies would have put fruit forward, and then an independent judging panel would choose or deem which one is the best quality one. And it is interesting to see that in this case, it's gone to a traditional dried fruit method on vines that are of a significant age. It does go to the skill of the operator in terms of producing that quality product.
Given how difficult it's been this growing season, these must be fairly significant awards.
Yeah, I believe so. I think it's been a really challenging year to produce a quality product. I certainly know in terms of my own operation, I struggled on a range of fronts with all varieties. And so I think that the people who won today or have received awards today have showcased their skill at producing dried fruit, and they should feel justifiably proud.
Simon, congratulations. You've taken out Best Sultana and also the overall Best Dried Fruit of the Year. What's your secret?
I have no idea. Actually, probably my dad's work ethic. it's just hard work and being very fussy about what we send in.
How would you say this season stacked up compared to previous years?
Really no different for us. We sort of just... No, it's the same as every other year, really. We were just lucky to beat the weather. Well, we just have just sultanas. We have the one variety, and we rack dry. We don't summer prune, so it's just... It just got off quicker, I suppose. Didn't have to wait as long because it goes on the rack.
If you're a more traditional dried fruit grower, it's a lot more labour intensive. So that means you're picking the grapes to get them onto a drying rack. A lot of people would be interested to know how you went sourcing pickers to get the fruit off.
Just advertising the paper, signs on the road, but mainly the paper, and hopefully you get enough. And that's pretty much it. Yeah, or you can try. Well, there's no backpackers around currently. Just that or bring Matic or all the whatever. But no, just paper this year.
And it worked out okay? You got everyone you needed?
Yep, all we needed.
A lot of growers in the region have had to dehydrate their fruit so that it's dry enough to send to the processors. Yep. Have you been in the same situation?
No, we just shake it and dry it on sheets and that's it. I haven't had to dehydrate for many years.
There's been a big push to kind of go to trellis drying, but maybe this season rack drying might have actually worked out a bit better.
Well, it could have. We're just probably lucky. And we don't have a big property, so maybe that helps.
How long have you been involved in dried fruit for?
Since I was born. But no, 10 years full time since I gave Dad a rest. And but pretty much been on the block since I was, on the tractor since I was two. And that's pretty much it, really.
And how big's the property?
Oh, it's only 17 acres. We did have two, but we've sold one.
Are you literally following in your dad's footsteps in terms of how you grow and dry fruit, or have things changed a little bit?
No, nothing's changed. It's the same as what Dad did and actually my pop before that. So, we're probably very old-fashioned in how we work it.
If this is the third generation that's farmed this particular property, does it mean that you're still working with the original vines that were planted?
Yeah, pretty much, most of them. Yep. Apart from, probably a couple acres. And the rest of it, it's all 80 years old or more at the moment.
I'm fascinated by that industry. Merbein Sultana grower Simon Chivers, or Shivers, who was winning the Dried Fruits Australia's Quality Award for 2022. There are other awards in Raisins, Sun Musket, Sun Glow and Currants as well. Congratulations to all of those winners as well. You're listening to The Country Hour. Let's head to markets. It is to market, we might start today with the sheep and lamb market reports, which means we head along to Bendigo and Jenny Kelly.
A few more lambs about with 13,700 yarded, with some dearer sales for the best export and trade lambs today, best meaning properly fattened in short skins. But once off the top pens, the market reverted back to being erratic, with secondary lambs cheaper by up to $10 in places. Export lambs made from $232 to top of $271 to average around 760 cents a kilo, although some pens not much over 30 kilos carcass weight did hit 800 cents. Heavy lambs, 26 to 30 kilos, $202 to $237. The 24 to 26 kilos, $185 to $206. The best neat trades, $180 to $200. All these good lambs were tracking from $7.50 to $8.20 cents a kilo. However, plainer woolly and lighter processing lambs dropped back to $700 to $7.40 at $150 to $178. Well-finished trade merino lambs, $184 to $210. More restocking activity on good store lambs, which were firm at $130 to $170 for the better types. Sheep prices were firm to easier. Big heavy ewes, $190 to $230. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Jenny. Let's head to the cattle markets now and go to Pakenham. G'day, Brendan Fletcher.
G'day, Warwick. Numbers decreased to 980. That's 130 fewer, with most of the usual buyers present, but not all operating fully in a cheaper market in places. Quality declined with fewer prime cattle and a larger proportion of cows. Trade cattle sold dearer on some sales. Grown steers and bullocks sold firm. Friesian manufacturing steers eased for plainer quality. Heavy cows eased 15 to 25 cents, while plain dairy cows lost 2 to 4 cents, with processors loading cows for an estimated 552 to 731 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls lifted 5. Vealers sold from 500 to 618. Yearling trade steers 557 to 624. The heifer portion 512 to 620. Grown steers 500 to 526. Bullocks 465 to 516, heavy Friesian steers 340 to 382, crossbreds 400 to 485. Most light and medium weight cows 206 to 350, heavyweights 260 to 385, heavy bulls 327 to 374. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Brendan. Let's head to Mortlake, and the cattle market there is with Chris Agnew.
Thanks, Warwick. Mortlake agents yarded a similar number to last week of 665. In a firm to dearer market where the heavier end of yearling steers gained 20 cents a kilo to be dearer in line with quality. Dairy cows gained 20 cents a kilo, and the vealers with shape sold from 530 to 600 cents, topping out at 745. The yearling steers and heifers, 468 to 550. Grown steers and heifers to a top of 528, making generally between 468 and 474. Manufacturing steers made to 425. The best beef cows to 390, and the general run making between 334 and 365 cents. The better bred cows back to the paddock, 285 to 344. At Mortlake, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
And lucky last is Leanne Dax at Wagga.
Good afternoon. Numbers jumped to 3,200. Quality was quite mixed, with not the big lines of well-bred weaners under 500 kilos. Heavy cattle were well supplied and the bulk sold to lot feeders. There was only limited competition from processors for the heavy end. There were very few cattle to suit domestic buyers also. A few veal, they made from 540 to 606. The market for feeder cattle was very erratic, however, at times achieved some great results. Feeder steers, lightweight, slipped 510 to 634. Feeder steers, 400 to 500 kilos, managed to gain 12 cents, $5 to 645. Trade steers, very few to quote, 478 to 566. Trade heifers were firm, 480 to 560. Feeder heifers, medium weight, 514 to 568. Lightweights were back 20 cents, 440 to 576 on account of quality. Heavy steers and bullocks to the processors dipped 30 cents, 405 to 486. Heavy feeder steers firm, 480 to 562. Heavy cows were firm to 2 cents better, 340 to 377. The middle run, $3 to 365. And cows are back to the paddock, 310 to 425. Leanne Dax, MLA.
Thanks for that, Leanne. Just before we go, some more of your thoughts. Peter says, g'day, Woz. I find some of the text responses you've had today to be ludicrous. Over the past 9 years, the Australian agricultural industry has seen our largest export market demolished because of idiotic ideology, lack of diplomacy, the rampant rorting of the water policy, making city living populations rich, biosecurity undermined, the CSIRO near gutted, whilst watching a rapidly changing climate gradually destroying many farmers' viability. Failures on wages, commodity prices and labour, and mines given much more higher priority by the so-called regional party encroaching on farming areas like the Hunter. Think, and maybe some of your audience need to have a bit of a look outside their narrow traditional views, says Peter on the text line. Anjit Aparagalan says, I bet the Liberal Party MPs that treated the eloquent and loyal Julie Bishop so shoddily are regretting that now as well. And Lee at Kudgy says, hi Warwick, I'm still waiting for a Saputo opening milk price. 8 days left for them to announce it. That's right, they've only got 8 days before the start of the new month and they need to have their milk price out by then. Thank you for all of your text messages. And thanks for everybody who got involved in our conversation hour today looking at foot and mouth disease as well. It's really important issue, and I'm glad we could take that to some metropolitan audiences as well. Very happy with all of your responses today. We'll catch you again tomorrow. It's 1 o'clock.